All right, everybody, welcome to Lecture 60 in this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We are continuing with the story of the critical period, and I think today you will gain a new appreciation for why some historians, and I certainly, view this as the critical period. What justifies that particular name? What was such a big deal? What's involved here? Why is this so significant? I think we will have a very good understanding of that by the time we're done today. So, step one in our efforts is to continue, as we have in the past, to work on this question of what to do with the anger facts, and continue. We keep having this kind of two-part class. I hope it's not too off-putting to you guys. I don't know how else to do it other than maybe we could do an entire class dedicated to this, get it out of the way, and then go back to the lectures. But I don't know. My feeling is that it works best if we do it. We have two-part classes, partly because one of the reasons why I like it that way is because I believe that when you're studying history, every part of it should connect with every other part, and that you should never fall into the trap of thinking that one, you know, that there's, you should only study one part of it disconnected from all the others. And so by kind of jumping back and forth here between periods, I'm hoping that you will not necessarily develop the habit, it's probably too early for that, but just kind of get comfortable with that approach, with the approach of always thinking of history as a domain that you can roam over at will, and that you should never be afraid of seeking connections between any part of it and any other part. In fact, that you should be ambitious about trying to do that. So if we're studying the critical period right now, why wouldn't we study the Reformation and religious wars in the same class? They are beautifully connected, as if we are accustomed to thinking in that manner, which is, I think, a very important thing to do. So, remember what we are trying to do here. Back to this context of picking anchor facts. What did we say about these three anchor facts? And we chose them and we said, they are anchor facts? And what else did we say about them? They're not just anchor facts. They're anchor facts because, actually, let's go back over that one more time, right? They are anchor facts because why? What are the three characteristics, the criteria we were using to weigh the usefulness of the anchor facts? One second, guys. I'm just going to turn off that noise, which is hard to deal with. And then I'll come back to sharing my screen. All right. So what are the three criteria for defining an anchor fact? I'm glad to see so many hands going up. Bria, get us started.
It's their significance to the past and the present and what they do to interconnect them.
Oh, well put. That's a really, you know what? You just said a whole bunch of stuff there, and which is beautifully put. But you actually combined more our criteria there really nicely. So if we would take what you just said and break it down, the first criterion of an anchor fact is it must be present-centric, which means it tells us something about the world we see around us. And then you said something else which is beautiful. Could you isolate the second part of what Bria said, Alexander, and just highlight it? What's the second part?
Which part was the second
part? Well, she said the present-centric part, but she said another thing. What else does an anchor fact have?
Oh, yeah, that it has to... that it has to connect to the other anchor fact.
Yeah, right. So Bria used the wonderful word interconnection, right? So anchor facts have to foster interconnection in our awareness so that all the parts fit together with all the other parts, right? And so these are all of them anchor facts, okay? And then we said, well, the third criterion was, is it helpful to us now, right? Is it helping us to learn about, sorry, maybe Timothy wanted to say that. so that we, you know, is it helpful to us right now? And we said all of these three facts do that for us. But our problem was this. We don't want to have to settle for collecting these three facts separately. What's the problem with doing it that way? Why couldn't we just look at these guys and say, well, you know what? We need all three of them. Let's just go ahead and pile three more facts on top of the others. Timothy?
Because then we would start to do that with all of it, and then before we knew it, we would have a plethora of anchor facts.
Well put. Well put. Exactly. If you try to deal with history this way, what happens is they accumulate, and they become this burden that you cannot deal with. Now, I'll tell you this, because it's not entirely fair to say that, because professional historians, guess what they do? And this is what makes them supposedly professionals nowadays. What they do is they spend their entire lives remembering facts like this. So they wake up every day and they read more books about the same stuff, and they memorize and memorize and memorize more facts. So that if you were to get a professional historian and put him on stage, he could spend a whole day telling you all the memorized facts that he knows. And so, well, that's supposedly what makes him a professional, right? Because he's an expert, and because he knows all of those facts, right? So there, it's not impossible to know all of these facts. Bria's got a thought. Go ahead.
What I would think is professional is if you can connect all of the facts that you have learned together to where instead of it's just Martin Luther creates a argument with the Pope. And then you'd say, well, the reason why is because this fact back then, and now we have this. It has to be, in my opinion, more future and past centric.
Okay, very interesting thoughts. And so, yeah, I agree with you, Bria, as well. So yeah, now that is not the standard nowadays. So if it was, then the textbooks would be very different, wouldn't they? Because the textbooks are 1,000-page plethoras, and that's what students have to do is memorize, and then they forget. And the difference between normal people and historians is normal people say, all right, I'm throwing this out into the junk pile because it's just nothing but memorization. And the professional historian says, no, it's precious. I'm going to do that for the rest of my life. And meanwhile, history becomes completely disconnected from life. So yeah, I agree with you, Bria. We need a new standard. We need a new approach, which is interconnection. And so that's then our task right here, though, is because how do you interconnect? In particular, if these things are important facts and we want to remember them, and we want to remember them in a useful way, and we want to remember them in a way that's going to permit us to not just constantly be juggling them separately, we've got to do something with them. We've got to do something with them. These facts are related. But right now, they're just barely related in our minds. I'm going to compare them back to my Tower of Knowledge metaphor. Remember the Tower of Knowledge metaphor? I'm going to compare them. They look kind of like this right now. In terms of our, I think these are Duplo blocks, right? They are the baby Legos. Our knowledge of these facts is kind of looks like this. So they're connected, right? If you were to think about Martin Luther and John Calvin, that's connected. And Henry VIII and Anglicanism, that's connected. Okay, but what's the problem with them just being connected? which you can see from this particular metaphor. If they're merely connected in our minds, which is good, it's a start, they're a lot like this. These pieces are connected. But what can't you do with this? Why isn't that good enough? Keen?
You can't build anything out of it. It's not structurally sound.
Exactly. It's not structurally sound. And knowledge is the same way. In order for you to build a tower of knowledge, it has to be structurally sound. So you have to take the building blocks, and thank you to Bria for reminding us of this word, and interconnect them. Okay. And so there's a name for that when it comes to historical facts. And the name for that process of interconnection is periodization. So what we're going to do together is we are going to interconnect them. We're going to think the heck out of these facts. And we're going to talk about it. We're going to know what they mean together, forwards, backwards, like Bria was saying. And then we're going to do something with them that we wouldn't be able to do unless we did all of that thought. And what we're going to do is we're going to fuse them. We are going to fuse them into a single thing, a single thought, and that thought has a name. It's called the Reformation and Religious Wars, and that thought will be a complex thought with multiple components fused together, and we will be able to use that as a component of building our tower of knowledge. And what we're going to see is that we got to get on this, because what we're going to see is that we need to do this sort of thing a lot in history. In fact, we're going to need to do it very soon with the American Revolution as well. Because if we say that the United States was born because of the Declaration of Independence, well, guess what? We're talking about the critical period right now. And if you look closely at it, is that statement true? The United States of America was born with the Declaration of Independence? That's a tough question, isn't it? It's an uncomfortable question. Is that really true, Keen?
So, in a sense, this is not a very good metaphor, or not a very good simile. It's not a simile, but you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
But you could say it's sort of like the fall of Rome. The Declaration of Independence is the official, you know, creation of the United States, but the ideas existed, well, they existed over 1,000 years before with, you know, ancient Greece and Rome, but, you know, they existed in the minds of the founding fathers, and they were already being practiced and thought of before the Declaration.
Okay. Now, you are absolutely right. And to extend this, you know, like Bria was encouraging us to do, as far back as you can go and forwards and so on. But my point was a little bit more specific in that it's this anchor fact that we have, 1776. It's all by itself there. And it's kind of like if we were to look at the Reformation, and we would say, oh, Henry VIII creates Anglicanism. So what are we're missing something there, right? I mean, if we are saying that the Declaration of Independence creates the United States of America, no, we're missing something. We're missing a whole rich story of interconnection. That goes back to the writs of assistance, that includes the Stamp Act, that includes all of the surrounding parts. It includes Patrick Henry standing up in the House of Burgesses and yelling, while he was in the church at the time, give me liberty or give me death. And it includes the Battle of Lexington and Concord and the shot heard around the world. And all of that leads us to the Second Continental Congress. It leads us to the delegates saying, Thomas Jefferson, please write us a declaration. And then they adopt it on the 4th of July. And then they fight the Revolutionary War. Washington crosses the Delaware. They get an alliance with France. They fight at Yorktown and win. They sign the Treaty of Paris. So, you see, my point is that 1776, oh yeah, that's the best. That is absolutely the cherry on top. But that is not the whole thing, right? And it would be really strange if we walked away from an American history thinking only with this one isolated event. We got these anchor facts and we're all kind of proud about our interconnections and everything, which they're all great. Nothing wrong with them, right? But we get to colonization of Jamestown and Plymouth, and then 1776, they're independent. Now you should be able to feel that will not do, right? It's at that point you have a chasm in your mind that should be very uncomfortable. You should be realizing, saying to yourself, oh, wait a minute, I don't really know. If that's what I got, I don't really know it. I mean, it's a start, and everybody's got to start somewhere. So a history of 1,000 facts begins with a few anchor facts. That's true. But we got to get, you know, we need to build more. And the American Revolution is one of those periods that we've got to fuse into an integrated awareness. Because it's just too richly packed with truth and beauty to leave behind. With just one anchoring awareness. That would be a travesty, in fact. We've got to have more. So we're going to do this whenever necessary. And in this case, we've got at least two periods that are indispensable. With regard to the Reformation religious wars, we need this. There's too much about American history that we can't understand without it. It's the bridge between early Christianity and American Christianity. And all of the ways in which America is this country dedicated to religious freedom. It's a necessary bridge. We won't understand American history without it. So we need that. And then we won't understand the world around us without the American Revolution being a well-fused, solid, integrated awareness either. And we'll see. Maybe there are other things that we need to know just as closely, just as well. Not too many. We need more anchor facts, for sure. But what we'll see is that we don't need that many more. So there's a few essential themes that we need to learn and then integrate in our minds. And once we do it, we'll know. We'll know what we're talking about. It's not the same thing as being able to regurgitate thousands of facts, but we'll know the story. And from there, you can go off and do what you will with it. You'll be able to build an amazing tower of knowledge because you'll have all of the structural parts, all of the framework, the structural framework for building a beautiful tower. Okay. Let's take a deep breath and go to part two for today's class. Back to this momentarily. Okay. What's the significance of this map? Why were we looking at this map yesterday? Alexander, go ahead.
Because all of these different states have all of these different claims, and they're pretty much separate countries. They aren't really united together like as in one country, but more united against the war. And once the war was over, they're pretty much separate states, and they all have overlapping claims. and they all have different rules and laws, and so they might fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well put. Okay, there's a lot of reasons for them to now view each other as competitors, as competing claimants, as, you know, not necessarily as allies anymore, but in fact as contestants, and you know, at some point, unfortunately, when conjuries see each other that way, it eventually, and history is very, very consistent on this point, it eventually leads them to serious conflicts. And if they can't resolve them, right, if they can't be diplomatic, if they can't be civilized, and that is the rarest thing of all. So they lead to conflicts, and eventually conflicts between countries means wars. And wars between states like Virginia and North Carolina, imagining something quite so drastic as that, as astounding as the thought is, right? But imagine such a thing would happen. Then what was going to accompany that? What was going to end up happening if these states could not resolve their differences, not resolve their sense of competing with each other for land, for trade, if they couldn't resolve other disagreements? What was going to end up happening? If they went to war with each other, what was going to happen? If it got that bad, right? At some point it would. What was going to happen, Alexander?
Well, they would get allied with various European countries, and then you would have France versus England in the United States, which aren't actually united, and then they would all, and it would turn into a giant battlefield, and nobody would, all the countries would just die out.
Yeah, exactly. To put it, you know, as to wrap that up really with a bow, if they had not managed to resolve all of these disagreements, there would be no United States of America. There we go again, right? There we are. This is what we should be looking for in history. These types of moments, these types of contexts, these fascinating problems in the past where we end up with a formulation like this. Without the resolution of the great conflicts between the states at the time of the critical period, there would be no United States today. We're at one of those moments again. So you know, this is a big deal here. The 1776 is wonderful, glorious, but it's not enough. Ideals must be put into practice, and that is difficult. You win the war, great. Now you've got to build a country. And I guarantee you, that's the harder job. So here they are, they've got all these struggles. And today, we're going to introduce another one. Because we could spend a whole class listing all these troubles. We already did yesterday, but we could list more of them. But today, we're gonna list one, and it's practically the only one we need. I mean, we could set all the others aside. We could set all the other struggles aside. All the ones we talked about yesterday, we could say, forget those, they don't really matter. They do, but not as much. And then we say, but there is one that really deeply, deeply matters. And if this issue doesn't get resolved, then once again, there's no United States. And history is very clear on this point. The deepest, most challenging problem of the entire period. Oh, does anybody know what it is? Slavery. Now we begin to look at a topic which is very challenging. To look at a topic that's very difficult, and which, not surprisingly, I cannot find enough reasons to disagree with the way that is typically taught. So in this class, it may seem like a peculiar thing to note, but it is worth noting, and I believe that it is fully justifiable, that we have not discussed it yet. So why haven't we? Most people know that there was slavery in the United States at some point in history. Why haven't we discussed it yet? Timothy, you want to hazard a guess? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it was because, kind of like the anchor facts, it really didn't matter until now.
You are truly and wonderfully correct, Timothy. Now, I have a follow-up question. Why did it not matter? Now, remember, what is this word? We use this word important, right? Meaning worthy of our attention. Now, most people would have a lot of trouble with this statement that slavery didn't matter. Are you kidding me? What about all those poor Africans? That's just wrong. How dare you say that it didn't matter? All right. This is a difficult one. This is a challenging topic. And I want you to notice that I'm taking it on, right? We're facing this one out in the open and head on, right? I absolutely will 100% defend my choice not to have discussed slavery to this point. And I'm absolutely convinced that this is the only point in which it is correct to introduce the topic of slavery. So, why is that? Timothy, keep going.
I think it's maybe because no one really, like, people just took slavery for granted, and like when they were just colonies. But then after the American Revolution, they start having to deal with all these things, so they can't just take it for granted anymore.
You're very close to the answer, Timothy. I'm very impressed. Okay? Very close here. When does something become important in history? This is a very deep, this is a big question. When does something become important in history? Right? We tackle this a lot, but I know that it's a very philosophical question. But we've working on this type of a question with regard to anchor facts and so on. We have some answers, right? In other words, with regard to anchor facts, for instance, we say, well, something's only worthy of our attention if it has some kind of present-centric, present-centric significance, right? Now, wait a minute. Is there slavery in America today? Why would we talk about it at all? There's no slavery in America today. Is slavery a present-centric topic? I trapped you. Timothy said no. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I think Keen might be able to do this one. Keen?
Well, we don't have slavery anymore, but the effects of slavery, we still see it in our society. You know, people, we still struggle with this problem of race and, you know, how
okay.
People of African descent are perceived.
That is definitely part of the answer. So there's a chain of effects and consequences that continue to proliferate in modern times. Right. So indirectly, yes, we can see that it continues to be, again, indirectly an issue. But that's not the answer. It's part of the answer, Keen. No, I shouldn't have said it's not the answer. It's only part of the answer. And there's a more important part of the answer. So I'm gonna get to the answer, but I'm gonna get there gradually. Okay, I'm gonna get there gradually. And I'm gonna begin with, I'm gonna take us back to 3000 BC. Remember how we're supposed to do this? How we're supposed to go ahead and interconnect all of our awareness? Okay, 3000 BC, this isn't 3000, it's more like 2500. And what do we see? Peyton, name it.
I'm sorry, I don't see anything on my...
What? You don't have a screen?
Yeah, I don't... Oh, there it is. There is slavery. The African-Americans are whipping the English, I think.
Oh, or no, no, no. This
I'm not quite sure here.
Okay, you're not sure of the context. This has nothing to do with African-Americans or any such thing. This is Egypt. And this is ancient Egypt. So this is just pure African slavery. African on African slavery. Or African on Mesopotamian slavery. This is, and the painting's called Israel in Egypt. So in fact, it's supposed to depict the Israelites enslaved by the Egyptians. And but anyway, it's just a part of, the Hebrews. So this is a part of the story of ancient slavery. As far back as you can look, again, Menes Narmer, 3000 BC, and the pyramid. Who built the pyramids? In a word, slaves. Thank you, Timothy. Okay, and so is that interesting? Would that be interesting? And let's take a look around the world here. Let's go from Egypt to Mesopotamia. Another famous ancient civilization. And we're going to study this next year. The Code of Hammurabi. A famous set of laws. And remember the basic motto of the slogan that everybody remembers for the Code of Hammurabi? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Right, here it is. If a man destroy the eye of another man, they shall destroy his eye. Oh, but wait a minute. If one destroy the eye of a man's slave, or break a bone of a man's slave, he shall pay only one half his price. What is completely taken for granted in the world of Mesopotamian law? Keen.
Slaves don't have the same rights as non-slaves.
Yeah, slaves. Slavery is taken completely for granted. Okay, the word slave here is just dropped in the sentence and nobody knows anything about it, right? Is anybody paying attention to the fact that the word slave is here? No, nobody is paying any attention to it. What about the Greeks and the Romans? Anybody know about Greece and Rome? What about those wonderful Athenians? They were amazing. They were the first human beings to have human thoughts. Bria, what about them?
Oh, never mind, sorry.
They had slaves. They absolutely had slaves. Here's our buddy the Romans. There's the emperor at the top of the stairs, watching as the general comes in through the city with what? What is this soldier doing with this old man's beard? And why is there a big, heavy piece of wood here and these men's arms are behind them? What about the Romans? Did they have a second thought about slavery? No. Thank you, Timothy. Okay, now we get to an even more difficult thought. What about the people of the Bible? What about Christianity? What does Christianity have to say about slavery? Was there a second thought there either? The Bible is full of references to slavery that are pretty much the same as the references of Hammurabi. Here's a good example. One of the students of Jesus, one of the so-called apostles of Jesus, is named Peter, one of the most important. He's writing a letter to the Ephesians. This is from the New Testament. And what does he say? Slaves, obey your masters. There was slavery in Christianity. What about Islam? Muhammad had slaves. Enough said. What about the rest of the world? Who built the Great Wall of China? Happy, well-paid laborers? Slaves, thank you. Here's an article from 2014, last year. Last year, folks. Now, here's the interesting question. Here's the interesting question. Why is this news? Timothy?
Back like 1,000 years ago, let's say this would just be normal, but it's not normal now because the world has changed. So that's why this is news.
That's why this is news, right? We are supposed to be living in civilized times. This is news now. People look at this and they are shocked, with rightly so. This is deeply disturbing. Why? Well, because we don't live in a world where we expect to see slavery anymore. Why not? 3000 BC, 2500 BC, 500 BC, circa 4 BC. Why do we not have slavery? What about the Europeans? When Columbus arrived in America, what do we know the Spanish did to the natives? Which a lot of people are really proud to be able to point out, because they think they're better than him. Alexander?
They enslaved them.
They enslaved them. What did the natives do to each other before the Europeans arrived?
I guess they enslaved them.
Enslaved each other, right? I mean, when the Europeans got to Africa, who did they buy African slaves from? Other Africans. Right, that Egyptian slavery story of Africa, that had nothing to do with Europeans. There weren't any Europeans. They were already enslaving each other. The world we live in the world of human recorded history, is a world full of slavery everywhere, absolutely everywhere. And by the time the Europeans are coming to America, they still have it. They don't bat an eye. When Dutch merchants arrive from Africa in Virginia with a ship full of slaves, Americans start buying them. This is normal. Now, to us, it's an astounding thought, because we live on the other side of a great divide. We live on the other side of a great transformation. But the real issue, what is so fantastical about history, is how on earth did we get to this side of the issue? How did we get here to be these righteous, presumptuous people of modern times who say to everybody else everywhere in all of human history, you were wrong. What you did was bad. How dare we say that? How did we get here? How did we get to have the right to say that? As with everything that human beings, every value that they achieve, every great step forward in progress in human history, somebody had to do it first. Somebody had to step forward. and challenge their fellow human beings. Somebody had to say, I think this is wrong. Everybody does it, but I still think it's wrong. I, me, myself, my own person with my own 2 feet, my own brain on my own shoulders, look at reality with my own independent mind and say, I don't care how many books have it. I don't care how many laws have it. I don't care how many religions endorse it. I don't care how many cultures accept it. I, me, with my individual mind, pronounce this wrong. Now that is the highest form of heroism that is available in the human experience. How many people can do that? How many people have ever done such a thing in human history? It's an astounding thought. We are where we are today. We are civilized. We are civilized human beings because a handful of Americans and a handful of English statesmen at the same time, on both sides of the Atlantic, had the courage to stand up and to begin the debate, had the courage to look at the facts and say, I think this is wrong. It's time for us to start talking about this. And how do you think they were treated? What happens to people like that? Who want to stand up to for the truth in societies that embrace falsehood? What happens to those people? Alexander?
Well, they get prosecuted.
Yeah. I mean, how do we treat the people who come forward with the truth? I don't like to say we in terms of an inclusive, but mankind has a dismal record, quite frankly, on this point. Individuals step forward to speak the truth against, in this case, all of humanity. Just think, I mean, nowadays, people sometimes will, make a hero out of this or that whistleblower who's going against this particular, I mean, yeah, don't get me wrong. I think Edward Snowden is a hero as a whistleblower. And most whistleblowers, to the extent that they are defending the truth maybe they're going against a law firm or a great company that's got billions of dollars and is doing something immoral and they're going to blow the whistle. I mean, yeah, those people are heroes. When to the extent that they're defending the truth against a great obstacle, that's heroic. But quite frankly, how can that compare to a hero that will stand up to all of mankind and say, you are wrong? All of human history, the entire record of all of human culture, and say, you're all wrong. That is the heroism of the abolitionists. Now, the founders were at the cusp of this transformation. Most of the founders were not what you could call abolitionists. Most of the founders were advocates of individual rights. They looked at human beings and they said, human beings are noble creatures that deserve to pursue their own happiness. And they expected their rights to be protected by the government, Once they had this thought, though, this was the seed of abolitionism, because then they had to look around with their independent minds and look at slavery and start to challenge themselves. Start to say, well, look, we have this. We inherited this. We have, and some of us, not all of them, but some of them have slaves. And is that something that we, as champions of individual rights, can live with? Isn't this related? Isn't this a contradiction that we've got to deal with? And to the great credit of the founders, this is where the argument begins. This is where somebody finally is willing to stand up and say, it's time to talk about this. It's time, in fact, you know, many of them were convinced it's wrong, and it's time to start doing something about it. But now we have, again, another reason to wrap things up for today, yet another reason why the United States is going to fail. Because you have some states with a ton of slavery, the ones in the bottom in particular, in the South, which is very notorious, of course, and some in the North that have almost none and that are eager to abolish it and will proceed to do so quite soon. So you have another split between the states. How on earth could they be united? And how do we get here? To this world where slavery is news, where we feel that we have the right to pronounce judgment on people that practice slavery and to denounce them as doing something that's wrong and to feel this great moral outrage at the phenomenon, where do we get the right to do that? We get it because the founders started the challenge. And like I said, there were also important English statesmen. One of them you might have heard of, William Wilberforce. Wilberforce is his name anyway. And abolitionists in England were starting the same debate. And so these men are the heroes that begin the process of eradicating slavery in the world. We're still not there yet, right? I mean, 14 million people in India are enslaved. And what is their government doing for them? That's pretty dismal. But we're going to get there. And we're going to get, at least, we're going to get to the modern United States, where we have the luxury of being civilized. Where we, like so very few people in of all human history, can look at everybody else in the past and marvel at the fact that we have such a better life. Now you have a new appreciation, I hope, for what the critical period means. I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that this is the most critical period in human history for all mankind. This begins a process that could not be contained and that's going to result in freedom for more people than have ever known it for all time. Isn't it amazing that people can think that history is boring? What's wrong with historians that they have managed to make this boring? Thank you for being here because it allows me to enjoy the fascinating story and to tell it again and to revisit it and to to marvel at how we came to be where we are. Have a good day, folks. Pick things up tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.